Hello everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And
we are historians.
If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we conduct intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we ask the question, what madness is this? Today we are so very thrilled to be speaking to Associate Professor Anna Clark, an historian and author based at the University of Technology, Sydney, where we are today recording this interview on unceded Gadigal land. Anna burst onto the centre stage of the history discipline when she co-authored The History Wars with Stuart McIntyre in 2003. Since then, she's written extensively on history education, historiography, and historical consciousness, including Teaching the Nation, Politics and Pedagogy in Australian History, History's Children, History Wars in the Classroom, Private Lives, Public History, as well as two history books for children, Convicted and Explored. You only have to know Anna for 5 minutes to know that her first love is not history, but fish and fishing. She recently combined her passions to write The Catch, the story of fishing in Australia. Anna is currently an Australian Research Council Future Fellow at UTS, where she is also the Director of the Australian Centre for Public History. Her latest best-selling book is Making Australian History, published in 2022 by Penguin. Anna, welcome to Archive Fever.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Anna, you have capital H history in your blood, which we can talk a bit more about later maybe. But tell us, when did you get your first taste of Archive Fever?
I started my undergraduate degree. I didn't do any history. I was focusing on what I thought were much more sensible subjects like politics and political economy. And then due to a timetable clash in my second or third year, I ended up doing an Australian history subject, I think a 19th century Australian cultural history. And in that subject, you were allowed to choose your own research question. In fact, that was encouraged. And I chose a sensible topic like, you know, the origins of Australia's first Labor government in the early 20th century. And I was just not really getting into that subject at all. And then I finally thought, well, why don't I do something completely different? And I ended up doing a topic on my second love after fishing, which is Australian rules football. And it was a study of the Victorian Football League during World War One. You know, there was a conscription debates and great class kind of conflict during the time and huge sectarianism. And so I studied what happened to the Football League, which was actually riven by these huge social and cultural debates in that period. And I got my first ever high distinction. And I thought, this is definitely the subject for me. Partly it was because I was able to study what I love, but also more importantly, and this probably gets back to the question of being hit by the bug, I could finish that research and that essay and have more questions than when I started. Like, it didn't have to be resolved. You could just get deeper and deeper and deeper. And the more you knew and the more you uncovered, the less confident you felt with that information. And that really suited my learning style.
And possibly your temperament as well. I feel
absolutely
that too. It's the rabbit holes that keep you there.
The rabbit holes and even the fence sitting, you know, that you don't have to sort of come down authoritatively, that you can have kind of complexity and nuance, and that's part of the story, and that definitely suits me.
Mm. And so tell us, what does Archive Fever feel like for you now that you're such a seasoned addict?
Well, interestingly, writing this book that we're going to be talking about today, it's changed a little bit. First, I felt that sense of being gripped that you sort of see people in the family history section of the State Library sort of, you know, reeling through microfilms, and it's like you're on the hunt of a detective chase. And I have definitely felt that. It's been exhilarating, and you feel you can't stop, and the day washes past, and you sort of come out at the end of the day, you know, sort of look for the bus stop, and you're all bleary-eyed because you've been sort of slightly carsick looking through microfilm. But it's changed for me as I have started to contemplate what an archive is, and I've started to expand my thinking about what an archive is. And now it also includes things like the exhilaration of finding something when you're bushwalking, or, you know, walking down to the beach and walking through a midden and thinking about what that is. And I suppose the feeling for those archives that are in the landscape, like archives that are in buildings and in paper, is that sense of a leap of imagination, this sort of tantalising threads back in time, and you can't necessarily put yourself in there because, you know, we are creatures of our time and place, but you can get a sense of what that existence in the past was like.
Mm. So does archive fever feel anything like hooking a big tailor? I mean, come on, be honest, which feels better? A Eureka archival find or catch of the day?
Definitely catch of the day. That could be just a sort of a primal gratification that comes from hunting, which certainly has never left my body. It's a very embodied sense. But there is a great thrill in finding a morsel or making that connection. You know, when you sort of get to a point in your research and you can start to connect dots and you're going, oh, wow, okay, I actually really might know what I'm talking about here. And that is very gratifying as well. Mm. But you can't eat that, can you?
No, it doesn't fill you up at the end of the day. Before we get on to discussing your latest book, let's just go back to the first publication success, The History Wars. What was it like being a young historian? You were actually still doing your doctorate in 2003 when that came out, co-authoring a book with one of the luminaries of the industry. Was it a privilege or a curse?
It was a huge privilege and testament to Stuart, who sadly passed away at the end of last year, testament to his generosity that that came about. As you said, I was a PhD student at that time, and I was studying the history of teaching history in Australian schools, and Stuart had been asked by the publisher of Melbourne University Press to write about the History Wars. He asked me to be his research assistant, which was very kind of him, and I was very grateful of the work. And he showed me a sort of a chapter outline of what he thought he would cover, and one of the chapters was exactly on my PhD research, and I just sort of mentioned to him that. And he said, well, I can see two ways through here. You know, obviously this is your PhD research, so I could just leave it and you can publish it, because if it was published in a book before my PhD, it could be problematic for the research, which is supposed to be original. And then he said, or you could just write that chapter, you know, and that was classic Stuart, that he didn't mind at all. And I said, well, how would you feel if I wrote that chapter? Because this is your book and your study. And he said, oh, I'd love that. That would be great. The conversation was incredibly generous, as I said, classic Stuart, looking after his students in a way where you felt like there was a great deal of care and mentoring. But to go back to your original question, was it a curse? I was absolutely not prepared for where that would end up. And I wouldn't say it was a curse, because obviously it gave me a professional leg up in ways that I probably can't ever repay, even if I wanted to pay that forward. But I was absolutely unaware of the politics and the division and the sort of heat of that debate that I felt like I had just been parachuted into. And if we go back to what we were talking about earlier about being a sort of a comfortable fence sitter, the History Wars are not great for fence sitters. You get pretty sore in the nether regions.
Unless it's a barbed wire fence.
And in fact, I remember the feeling of, you know, being asked to write opinion pieces for the media, and they would come back to me and they would say, can you be a bit more strident? Because obviously, you know, being a fence sitter and being sort of instinctively moderate is not great for op-ed pieces where they want fiery debate in their pages. Anyway, needless to say, it was actually unnerving. And it was also unnerving to see myself as pretty kind of moderate, but to be labelled, which the History Wars tends to do, because it relies on division. So you can't actually be a fence sitter, really. I found that uncomfortable, but I wouldn't say it's a curse.
The politics aside of publishing into the History Wars, what did you learn about being a historian and being a researcher from working so closely with Stuart MacIntyre?
I guess I learnt the incredible power of generosity. Mm. He never gave that up. And the more sort of distinguished he became, in my experience and with so many students that I've talked to, that sense that you can bring people with you So I think that was a great lesson to me, and I'm sort of at the point, I suppose, in my career when I'm only just starting to be able to do that, you know, to give people work or to help give advice. And so that's been, you know, really gratifying to sort of be able to enact a lesson that I was taught. He was very kind of gracious, and he was also excellent at taking on board, you know, if someone wrote to me and said, oh, I think you've made a mistake here, and it would make me very anxious because I was sort of just young and I wasn't sure. And he said, oh, the best thing you can do is just own up to it. And, you know, so he gave lots of kind of practical advice about how to be a historian and to deal with, I suppose, audience and feedback, and also to be able to write to an audience. Historians need to be able to shift gears a little bit, and the sorts of articles that we might be writing for our peers might be quite different if you're sort of trying to reach a broader public audience and debate. And that was really useful to see. And so as I was writing my only one chapter and he was writing his many others, I was sort of able to see him changing gears, and that was really useful to see as well.
Anna, you're a fully fledged distinguished scholar of your own now, on the brink of your own professorship. But you're also quite unique as an historian in that you mostly write history about the writing of history. So technically you're an historiographer.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about peak nerd. Tell us and our listeners first what historiography actually is, and then what attracted you to writing about historiography in the first place.
Yeah, it is a bit meta, isn't it? Historiography literally means the study of the history discipline, or the writing about the history discipline. So if you were to write a history of history, that's known as historiography. But I think I'm sort of interested in the blurriness, or perhaps the limitedness of that definition as well, because of course history isn't just written. It can be sung, it can be etched in stone, it can be passed on through family stories. So I think there's something to be said about studying the history discipline in that sort of official disciplinary sense, because how it has changed over time tells us about our society and about forms of education and about forms of knowledge. But I also think that we need to push at the edges of that definition at times to say, hang on, what was and wasn't included in our definition of history and therefore historiography? And in fact, if we did a kind of a historical map or a timeline of the term historiography, even that would change over time. So oral history, for example, would not be in what we would call historiography perhaps 70 or 80 years ago, but by the 1970s and 1980s it was well and truly there. So it's a useful definition, but it's not perhaps as firm as we might think it is.
So you have an author's note at the beginning that distinguishes between capital H history and little h history.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the difference that you're talking about now?
Yeah, that's the difference I'm talking about now, but that changes over time. And the hard thing about writing about that in the book is I sort of sensed that I might get myself tied in knots, because even what is history and what isn't history, or what is historiography, what isn't historiography, changes. But I think what it excludes at a point in time is as important as what it includes. And that is partly why I'm so interested in historiography. It tells us, particularly in a settler colonial society like Australia, where the act of producing the national story has been so important to establishing that settler colony, understanding what is and isn't history is a very important part of that. But it's never quite concrete. And I was very struck in thinking about this book and researching and writing it that there was history happening, capital H history, if you like, empirical disciplinary history happening from very early on in the colony, but there were counter histories happening all that time. And so that sort of negotiation and that relationship between the ins and the outs, between the historied and the unhistoried, is really, I think, part of that story.
So you've just written this history of Australian history. What were your archives for that book? Where do you draw the bounds of
oh, God.
What you include in your study?
Well, that was a huge part of you know, if you could think of it as a map-making project, that was a huge part of just the beginning. It's like, where do you even start?
Yeah, so you're defining the archive in a way.
Yeah, I was defining the archive, and the archive is both a kind of a temporal archive. Mm. Where does it begin?
Mm.
But also it's a spatial archive. Where is it in relation to the historians who were writing or producing histories at that time? What were they using? The archive is mostly a written archive. This book is mostly about the discipline of history. But the discipline of history not only changes over time, but it is defined by what it has excluded as much as what it included. So the colonists were literally putting up tents in 1788 and chopping down trees. They were writing about it. They were historying this place. And in that act of historying and saying the silence has been overturned by this kind of colonial noise, they were relegating other histories, Indigenous histories, to outside the story of Australia. And so I was then interested in not only what these early colonial histories were producing, for example, like the works some of listeners might be familiar with, like Watkin Tench, Judge Advocate David Collins, some of the very early historians such as Lang and Wentworth and so on, but what were the histories that might have been happening outside those texts? And there are incredible pieces of contact art, for example, around Sydney, and you can see them to this day. You know, you can drive up to the National Park in Cadie and on the rock, engravings of masted ships. And for me, that is a very obvious example of some kind of attempt at history making. It's telling a moment in time of some sort. And for me, as a historian of Australian history, the next question is, how do I include that if I don't necessarily have the language or the epistemology to interpret that history making? But if I don't try and include it, or if I don't at least acknowledge it, that is an even greater cost, I think.
And you're contributing and to the silence.
Exactly, exactly. And you're contributing to a very narrow interpretation of what Australian history has been.
Anna, unsurprisingly, your bibliography in this book, Making Australian History, runs to over 60 pages.
Yeah, that's my archive.
Yeah, your archive is
one
what
of them,
other
part of them.
Things that have been written about Australian history, other books.
Yeah.
But as Greg Denning always told us first year history students, what you see in the final product is always just the tip of the iceberg of research. That's only a tiny fraction of our archival endeavours will ever see the light of day. So how many books did you actually read that form the invisible base of your research?
I couldn't even begin to tell you, Claire. Heaps. And some of those books aren't even necessarily Australian history texts. They might be, you know, histories of history from anywhere, or they might be a model of how we write stories, or it might be a snippet of something that somebody told me when I was walking in the Kimberley and somebody was talking about layers of time or a cosmological event. It's hard to put that in your bibliography, and yet it's absolutely there, a sort of ballast of our work, if you like, part of the process of how I came to telling my history.
Anna, one of my favourite chapters in this book is the one about emotions. You note that, you know, historians under a disciplinary kind of conventional academic model are not really meant to have emotions or even to talk about them. But of course, we all do. You know, we often come to our research topics for very emotional, very personal reasons. So I found that really refreshing that you kind of acknowledge that. But it made me wonder about the emotions you experienced writing this book.
Mm-hmm.
What were they?
A lot of frustration. No, in terms of what brought me to writing this book, the motivation, I suppose it was twofold. One of them is I'm really interested in why Australian history kind of matters and what it means to different people and why it's so political. So in a sense, it's a very obvious extension of that interest in the sort of texture of Australian history. But increasingly, I've been sort of aware that the history discipline, of which I am a great beneficiary, has been complicit in the colonisation of Australia. And so I was interested in telling that story as well.
But that's not an emotion, though.
Well, it is, because it's about feelings of, I'm not going to say guilt, I think that's too simplistic. Shame, potentially, urgency. wanting to understand, like a kind of an awareness, a sense of something that you have been trained in and are very cognizant of the apparatus. But it's like an awakening of what that might mean or what that has meant over time for people who don't have the language and the architecture to build their own building blocks. So if we can go back to your original comment about the archive, which is really interesting about what was my archive, I became increasingly interested or motivated, if that's an emotion, to understand, for example, a major archive which is only a few hundred metres from us, which is the State Library of New South Wales, why that was established, whose stories it's telling. And right next to that building, the convict barracks, which were built by digging up Aboriginal middens and burning them and turning them into the lime to make them water for those colonial buildings. And so one archive was being destroyed to create this colonial civilization that went on top of that land. So where are those stories? Yeah, I just felt it like an urge to understand, and I don't know if I have the power to make it more just, but it was definitely a desire to expose and to understand. I was drawn to it, for sure.
Well, that suggests a kind of calling, which takes you into another realm, which is more kind of spiritual necessarily than emotional, but maybe we won't go there for the minute, beyond the bounds. Anna, one of the parts of the book that I like the best was your discussions of deep time. You use the Brewarrina fish traps, which might be as much as 40,000 years old, as an example of what you call the opaqueness of deep time, an opaqueness that challenges history's obsession with chronology and precision. Tell us about the fish traps, which obviously seem to coalesce your two great loves. You really do write very beautifully about them.
Oh, thanks, Claire. The Nunu, as they are known in the Nemba language, are this extraordinary maze of rocks that have been placed in the middle of the Barwon River by ancestors many thousands of years ago. They don't know how old they are. They could be 3,000 years ago old. They could be 13,000 years old. They could be 40,000 years old, which would make them the oldest human-made structure still standing. What's incredible about them, obviously as a reminder of human antiquity and where they are in a landscape, which is a town in central western New South Wales, which has its own sort of extraordinary history of race relations and colonial history and what might have once been called pioneering history. And the Nunu have stayed constant throughout all of that, but they have been interpreted quite differently. They were seen as curios of an ancient and timeless past. They have been blown up and bulldozed in the pursuit of progress. And they were originally, prior to colonisation, they were used as a gathering place. When rivers were filled with fish, there were hundreds and hundreds of Aboriginal people from neighbouring tribes who would come together. And they are actually marked. There's a demarcation in the traps and in the banks of whose part was where, that the fish, the running of the fish, would bring these people together. But then there's a period of time when the river becomes, as historian Heather Goodall has noted, a site of segregation. So they went from a place of bringing people together to a site of segregation. And now, in contemporary interpretations of the Nunu, there's a sort of an act of generosity that's happening on the part of the custodians who are sharing it with all of us, which is that we, as settler Australians, non-Indigenous Australians, have a kind of a human connection into an ancient past, and that there is this sort of thread of humanity that links us through this place which we can see. I mean, this is Bruce Pascoe's argument, that all of us can feel connected to this place of Australia. And so I found them to be a very powerful emblem of changing understandings of Australian history. But they're also an extraordinary archive because they hold stories, and they are form part of a sort of embodied archive because people are still fishing there now and using the fish traps as their parents and grandparents, and perhaps for maybe 2,000 generations have been using them. I find that incredibly, I suppose, challenging as an Australian historian and how we incorporate that archive into a practice, which certainly my training has been based on paper. And even though I love fishing, I haven't thought of it as a historical practice before. But I think it's really important as historians, if we're extending and expanding the timeline of where Australian history begins, it doesn't begin with colonisation.
Anna, you end Making Australian History by kind of grappling with the question of whether the university-based history profession can incorporate Indigenous understandings of country, but also Indigenous understandings of time, you know, time as circular, non-linear, the kind of idea of every when, all times existing at once. These are questions I've been grappling with a lot recently as I, like you, go on this journey, I suppose, of realising how complicit our profession has been in the settler colonial project in this country. In the book, you sort of leave these as kind of questions, but I want to kind of, I suppose, press you a bit on that. Mm. Where have you landed? Do you think the history profession can bring these ideas in, or do we need to kind of imagine a totally different way of making history?
I don't want to completely forego the value of the discipline, because I think that would be politically pretty dangerous in the Australia in which we now live, where being able to take on powerful truths, I think, is really vital. And I think there is a role for example, teaching students, school students, about Australia and the nation they live in. And that includes some of the many beneficial things from the history discipline, which is critical thinking skills, source criticism, being able to interrogate your sources, being able to understand things like chronology and cause and effect. You know, these are very linear, chronological. They could be problematic, but I think they also have real importance and weight. But at the same time, and this is where I land in the book and perhaps where I'm landing right now, if you like, those very challenging questions also help us to understand that history is a product of a culture. Mm. Even terms like objectivity and truth and evidence are also products of a culture, and that they also change over time. And instead of perhaps us trying to reconcile the two into a sort of a third way, or that we need to sort of forego history altogether, Western empirical history, if you like, I hope that this discomfort, rather than being a sort of blockage or a tension, becomes more of a productive tension or a creative tension, and in fact helps us to understand the context in which empirical history comes from and the sort of baggage, if you like, that it contains. And some of that baggage is really useful and helps us understand the world, but some of it has been part of this really devastating colonial project, which has silenced other histories and has excluded peoples, first peoples, from the sort of national story for a long time. And there's a danger history could colonise those stories if it isn't open to an understanding of where it has come from and the baggage that it holds.
Okay, spoiler alert, Pod Squad. Anna is the granddaughter of probably Australia's most famous empirical historian, Manning Clark. Anna, I wonder whether you ever wrestled with Manning's ghost as you wrote this book, given that Manning wrote the definitive six-volume history of Australia, which is empirical chronological history par excellence, you know, possibly part of the colonial project that we are talking about. Did you feel that part of your urgency, or do you feel that part of your calling is connected to your own family's legacy in the way that I know a lot of people who live on the land now and farm and feel that they are having to look back at the way that their own families were complicit in frontier massacres. Mm-hmm. I remember Cassandra Pybus's book about Truganini in Tasmania. She talks about realising that her ancestors had been part of the Black Wars. Is part of your own personal journey wrestling with your family's legacy?
Part of that perhaps only a psychologist can properly answer, because I have felt my whole interest in history, or shouldn't say interest in history, but in my professional career, I have just tried to park him. Those listeners won't see me blushing, but I am blushing. I don't like talking about Manning, although I loved him very much, I was sort of close to him in many ways. He taught me to fish. I used to drive down the Hume Highway to watch Carlton games with him. And I got lots of stories about place and history in those moments that I shared. This is going to sound perhaps implausible, but it is absolutely true. When I received the good fortune of government funding to be able to do this project, I didn't even think that I might have to talk about him. And then I got it and I was like, oh, shit. How do I deal with him? And so I reckon if someone else was to do this book, Manning would probably figure more prominently. And it's part of my discomfort that I've parked him mostly in one chapter, which is on family. And I thought that was a way of being able to think about family and about legacies. So that's one response to your answer. The other is I'm obviously deeply aware of his role at some level as part of that kind of institutional empirical foundation, in that his first sentence is civilization came to Australia in, you know, I can't remember what it was, 1788 or something. So he obviously had ideas about what's history and what's not, but they were challenged over the course of his life, as I mentioned in that chapter, as my understanding of history has been sort of challenged over the course of my life. I'd like to think that my relationship in this book is sort of perhaps gently professional to Manning, but I can't deny that the figure doesn't play on me. And in fact, I became most keenly aware of the politics of history when I was in Year 12, and there was a big attack on Manning's legacy after the Howard government got in, and there was a sort of real attack on Manning for being an agent of influence, for being a communist spy, which just seemed totally implausible to me. But I understood that historians were more than just nerds, yeah, that they had currency and that they could be boosted and torn down according to the political whims of the day. So in a sense, you know, I was only still a child when I saw that happen, but my registering of the politicisation of his legacy by various people of different persuasions showed, again, that Australian history matters, and it's more than just the facts. It's about how it tells us as Australians who we are, but it also sometimes has the power to tell us what we don't want or what we do want. And there's a sort of a very curious relationship about the histories that are being told and how they're registered and amplified or silenced. And so, of course, there's an element of that there in my connectedness, even though I'm literally still blushing while I'm talking about this.
Anna, you've been tremendously generous in the way you've answered our questions today, particularly that last one, and I thank you. Stuart taught you well. We're going to have to wrap up. The last question we'll ask you is the one that we ask all our guests here on Archive Fever, Archives Anonymous, we like to call it sometimes because it's a safe space. But do you have a dirty little archive secret you would like to share with us?
What counts as a dirty little archive secret?
You can interpret that any way you would like.
I have a funny one, maybe. It's not an archive secret, but I suppose one day it will be archived. When I applied to do this book, this goes back to your last question, you get peer reviewed by people in the field who write reports about your application, and one of them called me Anna Blaney. No response.
Granddaughter of Geoffrey Blaney. They're all the same, those out. Great white women.
That is great.
You can read that how you like, and if you think that makes this book more or less interesting, that's absolutely fine.
You're right. That'll end up in some kind of bureaucratic ARC archive one day. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Anna. It's always great to have a yarn with you. Anna's book, Making Australian History, is published by Penguin and is available from all good bookstores, virtual and analogue. We'll put links to Anna's other publications on the website.
You can follow Anna on Twitter at Anna Hope Clark, and you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2 and 3 via the website archivefeverpod.com, as well as our bonus episodes from Sydney Writers Festival and Adelaide Writers Festival.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded today on unceded Gadigal land and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. Coming up in the next episode.
It was kind of fascinating to see this, and that was one of the areas where the archive had something recorded wrong that just sat there forever and ever before anybody picked up and said, hang on. And that changed the history of science. It changed what we think about orality. It didn't really change it. I think it supported the ideas that elders have been screaming from mountaintops for forever. And Westerners finally come in and say, hey, there might be something to this. Yeah, there's something to it.